I appreciated hearing our children reflect on what it means to be a shepherd, because I would imagine that most of us feel fairly distant from that practice and role. But this is less the case in the British city of Brighton, where in recent years there is a trend that has emerged, a trend of urban shepherding, as it's known. Now, this started when the city council of Brighton began using sheep as a cheap and eco-friendly alternative to mow the grass in some of the city's sprawling parks. And so they then put out a call for volunteers, because you can't just have sheep roaming freely in the parks. You need volunteer sheep herders or shepherds. And so in this coastal community that has a large number of retirees, the slots filled up very quickly. 72 people signed up as urban shepherds, with another 50 placed on a waiting list and many more turned away, and just on the first day of signups. Well, to train these novice shepherds, the city offered a one-day course, and it featured such skills as what to do with an ailing sheep that had fallen behind, and how to ward off aggressive animals that might approach in the park. It drilled the volunteers on such skills as how to clamber up steep slopes, and how to grapple with an uncooperative sheep, and how to handle electric fencing. Now, it was not all smooth. There were some especially tense standoffs with dog walkers in the parks early on. But in the words of one urban shepherd, a retiree named Vivian Eliades, it is a lovely way to spend an hour or so being out in the fresh air. I go along two or three mornings a week. I make sure there are no holes in the fence. I check on the sheep, and I'm also a knitter, and I've even gotten some wool out of the deal. Well, with our distance from sheep and shepherds by time and place, perhaps shepherding evokes some pastoral images of green pastures and still waters and some comforting woolen scenes. Maybe it seems like something that could be enjoyed a couple mornings a week as leisurely exercise for a couple of hours while you drink your cup of coffee. But in the ancient world, this was not a waiting list job. Shepherds had a hard life because shepherds faced all that their sheep faced, and that included so much hardship. And they didn't face it merely as one among the flock. They faced it as the one responsible for the whole lot. They were just as vulnerable to the elements, to animal predators, to tense standoffs, to thieves and bandits, and to a host of other threats. Their lives were isolating. They were poor prospects as spouses, since they would leave behind a vulnerable family for long extended periods of time. The definitive characteristic of an effective ancient shepherd was that they lived a life that was not for themselves, but a life that was for the flock. And I am the good shepherd, Jesus says in our passage today. I know my own. My own know me. As we've mentioned this morning, in church tradition, this Sunday is known as Good Shepherd Sunday, and it reminds us of the God who loves us and keeps us, the Christ who finds us and calls us. And it centers on this image that is perhaps the most beloved and comforting in all of Scripture, the shepherd, with all of these associations of still waters and green pastures, all of these reminders of the one who walks with us in our times of ascent to the highest places, but also, and especially so, even through the very valleys of the shadows of death. In Matthew and Luke, the image appears as Jesus tells the moving story of the one who leaves the flock to find the one sheep that is lost, 99 others left behind. But that one is found and is returned to a place of safety and rest that we ourselves can almost start to feel. Well, in the Gospel of John, where we read today, Jesus doesn't tell the story of the lost sheep, but Jesus does proclaim, "I am the good shepherd." And then he begins to tell us what this means, that he seeks us, that he enfolds us, that he keeps us, that he guards us against the wolves and the forces that come to destroy, and that he even lays down his life for the sheep, Prior to the verses that we read today, he describes how he calls his sheep by name. They know his voice. They turn to follow. And then in John 10:10, just before our passage, he tells us the reason for it all. I have come that you might have life, that you might have it abundantly. More than day-to-day survival, more than just getting by, Jesus wants the sheep to live. And Jesus not only wants us to live, but to live with abundance that can be known through following in this way. Now, this is not some sort of elevated status. This is not a distant commitment. This is not a hobby or a morning routine. It is a vulnerable life. This kind of life that Jesus lives for us and with us and right alongside of us and always prioritizing us. Jesus journeys with the most vulnerable. Jesus takes on all of their vulnerability. He knows them even by name so that Lazarus he can call out in the Gospel of John and beckon him even out of a tomb. Or Mary, he whispers in the garden of resurrection. Or Thomas, he will say still later as he comes back for him, put your hand here and believe. Or Peter, as he will say on the shores of his regret, he knows them all. And he always comes to find them. And that's why we read these stories about shepherding right in the midst of this season of Easter, because this is an image of resurrection. This is about new life and possibility that visits us in the one that comes to find us. The resurrection itself is an act of this very good shepherd who is always counting, always finding who's missing, always coming back for even one, Mary, Thomas, Peter, you, and me. This is the same truth that we see in the miraculous sign that precedes Jesus' teaching on the shepherd in John 10. If you look backwards just a bit, you'll see that our passage picks up in the middle of a speech that Jesus is giving to the disciples and to the crowd about something that they had just seen and heard about in John chapter 9. Now, in John, Jesus' miracles are called signs, you might know. They're signs because they are followed by a teaching about what the sign has pointed to in Jesus' identity. For example, Jesus feeds thousands with but loaves and fish, and the people, they're trying to make sense of it all, and that's when Jesus declares the meaning. He says, I am the bread of life. Those who come to me, they will never be hungry. And this same pattern of a sign followed by a teaching occurs in this section of the gospel, chapters 9 and 10. And so his statement, I am the good shepherd, in chapter 10, is a direct reference to a sign that occurs in chapter 9, when a lost sheep is found, is restored to community through the voice and the vulnerable love of the good shepherd Jesus. The sign is one of my very favorite passages in the Bible. Some of you may remember it. It describes a man who is born blind from birth, and Jesus passes him one day. And as if to bait Jesus, some leaders ask, well, why is this man blind? Who sinned? Was it this man? Was it his parents? As though hardship like this can only come from his own mistakes. As though it was his own wandering that found him lost. As though it was his own mismanagement of his life that left him destitute and desperate. As though somehow he deserves what he has as they deserve what they have. But Jesus dismisses their questions. And he dismisses with that all of the assumptions behind them that people get what they deserve. And then without explanation, he spits on the ground. He makes mud in the dust, and then he pastes it on the eyes of this man. And he tells him to go and to wash it off. And then Jesus, hands still smeared with all of the dirt and the mess of this, he departs. And when the man returns, he can see. He can see for the first time. Well, people don't know what to make of such astounding, stunning, life-altering grace offered here so freely in abundance. We never know what to make of it. So they start asking questions. They start trying to make some sense of it. They start trying to fit it within all of their categories of understanding. And so the man tries to explain, but to no avail. They even bring in his parents. They look for some kind of rationale until finally, exasperated, this once blind man, now seeing, says, "Look, all I know is this one thing. I was blind, and now I see." Which is not enough for all of those searching for answers. And so they drive him out. They leave him a lost sheep once again. And that's when Jesus does what Jesus always seems to do. He knows his sheep. His sheep know him. And so Jesus goes to find him. And when he speaks, you can notice what happens. The man's head turns. It turns like Mary's in the garden of resurrection, because this man who had never seen Jesus' face clearly, he yet recognizes his voice. He turns to hear Jesus telling him of abundant life, Jesus welcoming him and saying to him, "I have come to find you." And we know this is consistently so counter to all of the ways and experiences of this world. Yes, so many leaders assume that the sheep exist for their well-being, for their gain, for their profit. So many manipulate and coerce. They get way out ahead. They pay no attention to those who lag behind. They never look for the lost and find space for the least. They never get their hands dirty in the dust of it all. They assume there must be something that these people have done to get themselves into their predicament. Yes, so many are like those false and faulty shepherds that the prophet describes. "Woe to you," Ezekiel says, "shepherds who only take care of yourselves. You have not strengthened the weak. You have not healed the sick. You have not found the strays. You have not searched for the lost." And you can imagine just how radical it would be in our world if more of our leaders, more of any of us for that matter, looked more like shepherds. But so often, in our preoccupation with power, we don't practice vulnerability and life alongside one another. And so often, in our fixation on security or our fears of what's ahead, all that is unknown, we don't give our lives away freely for others. In our conformity to all of the patterns and categories of this world, we don't use the gifts of God for the sake of a wider community and call. That's why perhaps the most powerful thing about a community of faith in Christ, the most powerful thing about a community seeking to follow in the way of Jesus, is that we get to imagine this world again. We get to envision it as it ought to be, as God intended for it to be. We get to practice a different ethic. We get to listen for a more graceful voice, and we can walk in the way made known to us by the one who has come to find us. This image of being found is one of the most powerful that I know for what it means to be community, and a community of Christian faith in particular. I think of a friend at my first pastorate who experienced this in a profound ways. He joined the church early in my tenure. James was a man who was gay and who was living with AIDS, and that made him twice the outsider in many a church. His illness had further led to him being undermined and pushed out of a successful career as a DC attorney, and so he had moved to New York City with big pieces of his life broken, which was unbeknownst to most beneath a polished and confident exterior that he projected. But his own brokenness and woundedness became known to us a few months later as James attempted to take his own life. And in this amazing moment of community, the people of the church stayed with him through it. They surrounded him in love and hope. They saw him not for all that was wounded or diminished, but for all that he was. Eventually, James's emergency stay in a mental health facility came to an end, and he invited me to meet him and a friend as he was returning home that day. And so we sat around, and we talked about all of this. We toasted his homecoming there in his apartment. And then he just, out of nowhere, began to tell me this story about how during the weeks in the hospital, he had met a young man who was also suicidal. Now, the young man had checked out earlier than he had, and James had wanted to make sure that this young man knew that he was there for him. The young man asked if they could stay in touch, and James said, look, I don't know if you exchange numbers in a place like this, but here's what I want you to know. I want you to know that if you ever need me, that you can go to 40th Street and 9th Avenue in the middle of Manhattan, and there's a church there. It's my church. And you can ring the bell. Someone's always there, he said. And whoever it is that comes to the door, they'll know where to find me. And he wept these words as he told me what it had meant to him to know that he was always found. You know, James went on to become one of the most gifted, committed members of that church during my tenure there. I remember when one of our members was struggling with a Parkinson's diagnosis. When she was journeying through all of this amidst the hard urban landscape of middle Manhattan, it became evident to everyone that she really needed someone to act as a benevolent friend and caretaker, and it was him. I remember when the church needed legal advice in some critical moments, how it was this man who had lost so much of his career and yet still retained so much expertise, he was the one that offered that for free. I remember when a new member of our church was seeking asylum and was running up against all of these barriers, and they needed a tireless advocate to stand up for them. And it was James. Because that experience of being known and found, it became the starting point of something new in his life, and today he calls that his resurrection. And when resurrection happens, it is not merely for our own comfort or assurance. No, Jesus doesn't leave us in the comfort of the sheep pen for long. Those green pastures, those still waters, those are not our home. Because Jesus describes in John 10 how he has to keep moving. He has to keep looking for those other sheep, he calls them, those that we might not see within the flock, those that we would not voluntarily welcome on our own. He must bring them in, and any who follow him, they must be about this work too. And that is always the motion and the call of the Good Shepherd. Once you have been found, you start to look more broadly in ways you never have before for those others who have not made it home yet. In fact, remember what happens when Jesus finds Peter. One of those stations of resurrection. Peter is off by himself. Peter is dealing with all of his regret at his denial of Jesus. Peter is faced with the fact that he is not as brave as he thought he was. And amidst all of his shame on the shores there, Jesus says to him, "If you love me, if you want to follow me, then feed my sheep." Because something transformative happens when you follow in the way of the Good Shepherd. Somewhere along the way, the sheep become shepherds too. There are 99, all safe and all sound. But there's one missing. The Good Shepherd says, "I will go to find them." But what if instead of the Good Shepherd leaving the 99 to go and search for the one, what if the 99 sent him out to do it? Come to think of it, what if all 99 followed behind him and started searching themselves? What if they had seen so much of this enfolding love of their shepherd that they had come to know in ways deep and transformative that none of them could rest until all could rest, that none of them were safe until all were safe, and that none of them were truly found until every last one has made it home. And may it be so. Amen.